Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to film sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
There, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. And sometimes, ladies and gentlemen, well, first off, if you're listening this weekend, which we appreciate, It's pledge drive. 1-800-233-0020 or go to WFYI.org to support the local programs that you get, like Film Sociology, The Blues House Party, Stolen Moments, and other programs that do not involve me. So 1-800-233-0020 or WFYI.org/give, and that's all we're going to pitch. Sometimes, ladies and gentlemen, this show turns into stage sociology because, well, I like to promote theater, especially when it's Shakespeare involved, and I've been known to get on a stage or two in my time. So it is that time of year. Bardfest 2018 is a happening, and we have and there was much rejoicing. So, yes, huzzah. So we have a gaggle of guests, so I'm going to have them all lean in and vocally announce yourself and why you're here. So, you know, and so everybody listening, commit their voices to memory so you know who's talking. So let's start over to my left, which has nothing to do with radio.
Glenn Dobbs, producer, Bardfest.
Hi, I am Zachariah Stonerock. I am the director of Romeo and Juliet.
And I'm Doug Powers. I'm directing The Merchant of Venice.
My name is Laura Kuhn. I'm directing Much Ado About Nothing.
My name is Audrey Dupre, and I'm representing Midsummer's Night Dream.
Representing a gang. Do you have jackets? With the you thought about that, haven't you? Yeah.
We should so, do
just,
a
just wings.
Yarmulke for you. So,
well, not for me.
Not for you, but anyway. So yeah, that is that. So what are the dates for Bardfest? They can go to. I know there's a Facebook page, and there's also indiebardfest.org.
com.
So.
Yeah, it's September 27th through October 7th. We run two weekends. There are four performances, and we're in two different theaters, the Indie Fringe Theater and the New District Theater on Mass Ave.
There you go. So take note. And we will get to them a little bit to talk about their plays and rehearsing and all their encounters with the Bard. We always like that. Now, ladies and gentlemen, opening in theaters this weekend, and I saw it this morning at the time of this recording. But yes, something to take your children to, a family show, Fahrenheit 11-9, the new film from Michael Moore. Yes, he takes on the Trump administration, but a lot more. There's that kind of Spike Lee, all over the place feel to some of this, but there is a through line, there is a connection to this. If you know Mr. Moore's previous work, like I do, there are times it's a little heavy. His approach can be a little heavy-handed, but it's kind of fun, especially if you agree with him. And I don't know if this film is going to change anybody's mind, but I'm sure it will. It'll make you want to dig your heels into the dirt and keep fighting the good fight, no matter which side you're on. It does start with, well, you know, the lead up to the election and the thing that nobody saw coming. And yeah, really good use of music from Pagliacci when it came to the moment in question. You know which one I'm talking about. But it also talks about how we got to that. He addresses the fact that the system is broken on both ends. Let's not forget he did lop Hillary off at the ankles in his documentary Sicko, and that's also kind of done here. But it also goes back to his hometown, full disclosure, my hometown of Flint, Michigan, and the water crisis and how it has come to this. So it's not just – and it's also a reflection of where – you know, whoever's in charge is a reflection of who is running the country and who we are as a people. So – there is a lot of that. With a documentary like that, I love that everybody's stone silent because they want both ends to see plays. So no, it's fine. I think it was Michael Jordan that said Republicans buy shoes too. So, but what the film does when there's a documentary like this, if there's a lot of it I know, then you know, for me, it's a little bit of a disappointment because I want to find new stuff. I use the great example of the documentary The U.S. versus John Lennon, which is a great 101 piece about John Lennon getting almost deported by the U.S. government in the early 70s. But unfortunately, I already knew that. So there is a number of things that we know about the Twitter stuff and the Putin stuff and the Big Daddy type relationship with certain members of his family stuff. But there was also other things that I did not know, like the son-in-law who helped finance the opening night party of Moore's documentary Sicko. He made that disclosure. The status quo as far as – I knew there was a partial burial of Bernie Sanders. I didn't realize how full it was. And most of all, for me – there is a moment they show when the last president who came to my hometown to address the Flint water crisis and didn't call for FEMA and didn't call it a national disaster and did a publicity stunt by drinking a glass of Flint water, which he really didn't consume. He just put the water to his lips and that was that. So just an example of the system being broken and what are we going to do about it. The film also addresses a new, young, up-and-coming group of people in politics and in civil rights, students that address the school shootings. There is a glimmer of hope on that. Anyway, long story long, yeah, I liked it. And if you like Moore's work, you're going to see it anyway, and it's going to do well, I hope. So anyway, that is out there if you need a break from The Predator or The Nun. you laugh because it's true. Also opening in theaters is we go from Fahrenheit 11.9 to Lizzie, the date film about Lizzie Borden. Chloe Sevigny plays the title role. Kirsten Stewart with an Irish accent plays the maid who, well, this is another one. Kind of a spoiler alert on the Lizzie Borden story, but I guess there are certain factions of the mall crowd that probably don't know the story. You know, we grew up, some of us grew up with The Little Poem, which we won't recite, but it's a decent enough film. Sevigny, I know this has been a passion project of hers, and I know she's been wanting to do it for a long time, and she's probably a decade too old to play it, but then again, Richard Burton was 40 when he played Hamlet, but that's true. But the film, I have a thing called the Grindhouse Rule. There's a lot of films that would just be better if they were 70 minutes long. Plays too, not you guys. You're all right, but and I think this film, even though it's not a grindhouse film, it's not an exploitation film. It could, but it doesn't. It could be a lot shorter because there is that they set the pacing for the era, you know, of repressed Meet Me in St. Louis looking Boston society, and the fact that Lizzie likes to go to plays unescorted, which is, you know, a huge scandal, and actually has a budding relationship with the maid played by Stewart. They do tap into that a little bit. The fact that she has no means, no say when it comes to her finances, even though her dad takes care of her, you know, because the dad takes care of everything and that you never question it or answer it ever. So it leads to a big buildup of what happens with the axe and the parents. Fiona Shaw is also in this playing the mom, Fiona Shaw is always solid. But the pacing, because I think, wanted to reflect the times. And I'm not saying it had to be a Michael Bay film, but you could speed it up a little bit. So it's a flawed exercise, and they handled the big moments quick and not so painless. So anyway, those are out there. Let's go check those out. All right. I want to go around the room a little bit because I love this question. When was the last time you went to the drive-in? Start to my left, which has nothing to do with radio. That's you, Glenn.
Yeah, I know, but I'm I'm trying to think of what year in 1970 I did that.
Really? That long?
Yeah, it's been a while.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, for me it was probably when I was a kid. I was probably like 12 or 13, which was more recently than the 1970s.
Wow, shut up.
I won't say when, but it's been a good couple decades.
Do you remember what you saw?
It's usually, you know, at drive-ins, it's not usually like movies that I'm too interested in seeing in general.
Abdul and I have joked about we want to show Bergman and Fellini films in a drive-in.
Yeah, but, see, you know, that I would be, yeah, yeah.
I'll test you on this. It was The Valley of Guanji.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that's not playing at Keystone, but it'll play at a drive-in. Yeah. Okay.
I do remember, I think, you remember the movie Congo with the...
When everything was written by a novel from Michael Crichton.
Yeah. So I think that was the movie that played, like, the late movie, you know, and we were leaving as it was starting, and I remember, like, scary for a 12-year-old image from that movie, but I've never seen the film, so...
You're really okay.
I might not get around to it. Yeah,
that's all right.
I'm pretty sure the last time I would have been at a drive-thru would have been my second viewing of Star Wars.
Oh!
Yes.
Do you remember how it went?
There's this guy called Luke Skywalker.
No, it's one thing when you're in a theater and you can hear the crowd reaction, but I don't think one is honking horns when a scene of coolness happens.
True. So. Yeah, no, I don't remember... It was the first time I had ever seen a movie more than once at the cinema.
Very good.
And I remember that Star Wars was but that tells you how long ago it has been.
Back when Han shot first.
Yes. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Which is always.
That's right.
I remember the setting of the drive-in. I don't remember the movie, but it was at Knight's Action Park in 2005, I want to say. So it's been a little while. It's not a legitimate drive-in necessarily, but they were playing a movie outside on a big screen.
You remember what it was?
I have no memory of what it was.
That's okay. Mm-hmm. That's all right.
About 2 years ago, I believe, and I think it was Cinderella.
Oh,
the live-action Cinderella.
Yes, yeah, Sir Ken's version.
I think so.
Cool. Well, with that in mind, we go to the Tibbs Drive-In, and sometimes you just get odd pairings. Sometimes it's the same genre, it's the same studio. We are of one. I point to Glenn, which is great for radio. I use the example of, you know, you could often use an older film for the second titles, for the second screening. And they can't do that anymore. But I remember, I think there was one, it was when Arthur had just come out and Dudley Moore was huge and inspiration to us 5'5" dudes who like Susan Anton. But the second film, was 10. So, you know, it was a 2-year-old picture, but it had Dudley Moore, and, you know, it was Warner Brothers, and they expected you to fall asleep by the time Bo Derek was running on the beach. I'm not answering that. So, with that in mind, we go to the Tibbs Drive-In, and on screen one, The House with a Clock in Its Walls, also known as a PG movie by Eli Roth, and Hotel... Wow. Yeah, I know. It's like the G-rated movies by David Lynch and David Mamet. So yeah, Eli Roth actually directed, and this is based on a young audience or young adult novel series I know nothing about, but it's Jack Black and Cate Blanchett. But yeah, The House with a Clock on Its Walls and Hotel Transylvania 3. Okay,
Halloween is coming.
That's screen two. You got The Nun and The Meg. And you have a film with Jason Statham fighting sharks.
Think of the space they're going to save on the marquee.
There you go. Screen three, The Predator and Peppermint.
Yeah. Just going for alliteration in that one.
Yeah, I know. That's why I'm over here. Screen four, A Simple Favor and Crazy Rich Asians. So, yeah. There you go. That's over at the Tibbs. Over at the Skyline in Shelbyville, you have The Predator and The Nun. Well, Yeah, Sammy Terry's coming too.
Sounds like they're set up for a joke. You just need one more person to walk into the bar.
They need a rabbi.
And somebody
done
to
that.
Walk into a bar.
That's right. So, okay, over at IU Cinema. Now, this, of course, depends on when you're listening to this. If you're listening on Saturday, thank you. You have a chance to run down at 7 o'clock on Saturday the 22nd at IU Cinema to see the 2017 art house film In the Last Days of the City. On Sunday the 23rd, I read about this last week and it just made me tickle because there are films there was a period where you could whatever was at the top of my pile, I just watched. It didn't matter if they matched or didn't match. And IU Cinema decides to have these kind of they're not double features, but you could see these back to back if you choose. And on Sunday, September 23rd, at 1 o'clock, you could watch Ingmar Bergman's Persona. And then at 4 o'clock, The Maltese Falcon.
Mm. Wow.
Talk about a palate cleanser, right? Yeah. You don't want to watch those the other way. then you have Haagen-Dazs and you roll up in a ball at the end of the day. So anyway, that's a chutzpah double feature right there, man. Monday the 24th, Never Fear from 1950. Thursday the 27th, Luz Obscura will be the documentary, and director Susana D'Souza Diaz will be in attendance. Another one, Friday, September 28th at 7 o'clock, Ingmar Bergman's Hour of the Wolf. And then at 10 o'clock, John Carpenter's They Live.
Oh, my goodness.
Right? Roddy Piper with glasses and scary Ingmar Bergman. That's very strong. Saturday the 29th of September at 4 o'clock, She Done Him Wrong with Mae West and Cary Grant. And then at 7 o'clock from 1982, Liquid Sky. And then Sunday, September 30th at 1 o'clock, Love is Potatoes, followed by at 4 o'clock, Zabriskie Point. Jeez, nice stuff there. All right, so that is over at IU Cinema. At the Historic Art Craft Theater, again, if you're listening to this on Saturday, you have a chance. At 2 and 7:30 p.m., Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Always good to see on the big screen. Tuesday, October 2nd, a 35-millimeter print of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Free movie courtesy of the Johnson County Public Library.
Wow.
And then Friday and Saturday, October 5th and 6th at 2 and 7:30 p.m., Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho.
Oh, yes.
Always good on the big screen. So, and, ladies and gentlemen, you have a chance to also go to Midnight Movies at Keystone Arts for the month of October. October 5th and 6th, the original Wes Craven, The Hills Have Eyes. You remember that, Doug? Yeah. Not a date film. No. October 12th and 13th, the Japanese film House. October 19th and 20th, Evil Dead 2. Yes, thank you, Bruce Campbell. And October 26th and 27th, 30th anniversary, new digital restoration, Tim Burton's Beetlejuice.
Ooh, okay.
So there you go. Mark your calendars there. All right, let's go to Bardfest. So, Much Ado About Nothing, Merchant of Venice, Romeo and Juliet. I guess, Glenn, there's no meetings, right? Individual directors come to you, and what turns out to be the trilogy turns out to be the trilogy that it is?
No, we sort of. Okay. We try to find a little bit of a balanced approach. We want to try to do a comedy, a history, sometimes a problem play, something that's more commercial and something that's more obscure. To provide a more bigger menu for Shakespeare than people normally get to experience. So in the past, we've done projects as well-known as King Lear and projects not as known as Timon of Athens. And so this year, a play that's not produced that often but is more well-known is The Merchant of Venice. It falls into that category.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the crowd-pleaser romantic comedy, the definitive original romantic comedy of Much Ado About Nothing.
Yes.
We have the whole pageantry of A Midsummer's Night Dream with a youth theater company that is just dynamic and outstanding. And then, of course, we have the classic Romeo and Juliet. With a real fresh look to it. So it's a nice menu, nice palette for everybody to take a look at.
Okay, actually, that's a really good setup. What is the fresh new approach to R&J?
Well, it's nothing earth-shattering. You know, it's just part of it is out of necessity, too. But, that's when you're, especially when you're staging theater, that just becomes a part of the art is just knowing what you have to work with and how to make that into... how to make it not just look like you're doing something because you had to do it that way, but because it's on purpose. It serves some purpose with the story. So for us, because it is a theater festival, we are sharing a space. For us, we're sharing the space with Much Ado About Nothing, and so it has to be in some ways it has to be kind of minimalist. So for me, I just really ran with that approach, and in thinking about the play, I never thought that it would you know, sometimes you read Shakespeare and you think, oh, this would be really great set in a certain time or in a certain place. Nothing like that ever really jumped out to me, and it occurred to me that really what jumps out to me about the play is how immediate it is and how universal it is, and so my idea is that it is taking place right this moment that you're seeing it on this stage, and it's kind of set in its own world, and so we started with that idea, and then we've kind of created our own world for the play, which is what you'll see is very minimalist costumes, hardly anything for the set, and really an opportunity to focus on the actors and the relationships
exactly.
of the characters in that show.
Yeah, and I think what's one of the strengths of Bardfest is because there is a small budget, and there's, you know, you have locations that need to be moved, and it's more focused on the story and the people, I think, than the characters. So is yours about bad parenting?
No.
Okay. Just
no.
Saying.
I actually object to that to that reading of the play.
All
I think
right,
there's a lot more that. So hopefully the audience will get a lot more than that out of it. If it's just about bad parenting, then it's just Spring Awakening, which is not a very good show in my opinion.
Hashtag theater humor.
Ooh, yeah. Boy. You'll get letters.
Yeah.
Not here. Send it to there. So, Doug.
Yes.
So now you have let's address the yarmulke in the room.
Wow.
Well,
yes, sure.
You got
yeah.
it.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I tell you what. For those who don't know, tell the story of Merchant, and then how are we going to tackle Shylock? Not literally, of course.
Right, right, right.
He'll tackle you back.
Well, yeah. So, in The Merchant of Venice, wow, how to summarize.
We got an
there's
hour.
There's a lot going on
yeah,
in this.
There's
in
a
this
lot
script.
Of story going
there
on.
There is a lot of story going on in this play. So a wealthy noble from Venice has an even wealthier friend, and he borrows, the young noble borrows a significant amount of money from his wealthier friend because he's very bad with money, so that he can go and do the sort of Prince Ali Ababwa thing from Aladdin to go impress a woman and end up marrying her who lives far away. And she's ridiculously rich. Mm-hmm. So he knows if he can get to marry her, all his money problems are solved, and it's great. But he's got to borrow the money to get there. And so he ends up borrowing the money from it's Venice, originally 1596, though that's not where we're setting it. He borrows it from a Jewish moneylender.
Yep.
Who, in this time, you know, there was a big conflict between Christians who did not think you should charge interest on loans and Jewish people who that was the only means of livelihood available to them. So, because they weren't allowed to own property. So,
but it's okay. There are good people on both sides.
Yeah. Anyway, well, I mean, there are, but that quote, yeah. Anyway.
Hashtag smart aleck.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yes. So the arrangement that they make is instead of charging interest, if Antonio, the wealthy merchant, doesn't pay Shylock, the Jewish moneylender, back, Shylock gets to take a pound of Antonio's flesh.
For once, proper use of literally.
Yes. Literally a pound of his flesh. And, of course, the young Venetian nobleman does make it to Belmont and... You know, I won't spoil for a 400-year-old play how it goes,
well,
but...
Well, you know, some people don't know it, so this is good. But
yeah, yeah. But so, but the point is that Antonio does end up forfeiting on the loan, and Shylock is prepared to take his pound of flesh, and there's a courtroom scene. So it becomes, in addition to a romantic comedy and a play about bigotry, it's also a courtroom drama. So, you know, it's a little bit of everything.
And women in drag.
And women in drag. Yes. Yeah. It's Shakespeare.
That's right.
I mean, of course.
So how what is the setting for yours, and how do we? Because
yeah.
this is for a lot of there are a lot of theaters that won't touch the play. It's
True.
Been years since I've seen it,
yeah.
and so yeah, it's because there's depending on how it's interpreted, depending on how it's presented,
sure.
and then people coming in with their arms crossed in the front row, ready to see what you do. So
sure, yeah. Well, our setting is in Italy. But sort of not a – it's sort of a mythical version of Italy, and it is – we're setting it in the 1930s, just sort of the generic 1930s.
Are there Italian women in fountains? That's Fellini in the 50s anyway.
right. A little later. But, yeah, so we're setting it in the 1930s, just generalized, no specific year.
Sure.
and in a sort of mythical version of Venice and Belmont. And yeah, so I think there is still sort of a lingering sense in the cultural mindset that this is an inherently anti-Semitic play, and that to produce the play is an inherently anti-Semitic act. Obviously, if I thought that were the case, I wouldn't be doing it. Certainly, there is anti-Semitism in the play, mm-hmm. and you have the character of Shylock, who I don't see any way to responsibly get around the fact that he is the antagonist of the story. You can't make him not the antagonist and still have a story, I think. It is certainly that's one of the big things about this play is how do you deal with the representation of Shylock? And I think the thing that's been very important for us is that he has a journey to go on. He's not the mustachio-twirling villain from the outset.
Right.
He is not that. He cannot be that, I think.
Well, and he's got a beautiful monologue, too. Just to remind folks.
A couple of them, actually.
Yeah, that's true. I think of the Pricus and, and all that.
Although you might be surprised how that one comes across in our production.
Look at that teaser.
That's right. That's right. That's right. But yeah, no, he is. He makes some terrible choices, does Shylock, and he becomes a would-be murderer. He does. There's no getting around that. That's right there. But if he is a monster, I think he is a monster of the making of the society that he is in and is, the victim of, if you will.
Or as certain novels, you say you would refer to him as a creation instead of a monster.
There you go.
If I could add something to what Doug's doing, Doug, all of them have done this, but Doug has staged this so brilliantly that not only are the speeches and the words just electric the way they come across, but you're going to leave the theater talking about it. You're going to leave the theater with questions, and it's going to provoke conversation. It's going to make people ask certain things about themselves and about the way the world is. And doesn't good theater do that?
Yes.
Isn't that what we all want to really do? With it, with Zach's production, even though people think they know it, the immediacy of it, the intimacy of it, the way that he has put this thing together is so fresh. It's so vital the way you see it. You fall for it every time because it's just written and done that well. So that's what's really great about Bardfest. And I think also with the other two productions you're going to hear about in a minute, mm-hmm. you're going to see the same kind of thing. But the reason we're so excited when we do the plays that are not commonly produced is people talk about them. They ask questions about them. They leave changed because of them, and that's what our central mission is.
But I love also the fact that when there is something that is known, to see a new take on it. And there are times where, and we've all checked the calendars for seasons, and sometimes we see shows in spurts, and then you see, four productions of the same play in 3 months. I'm like, I'm good for a decade now with the show. But, I mean, it's if people can watch the same movie over and over and over, I see no problem with being able to see R&J or Much Ado or Midsummer or Merchant of Venice, four times in a year and a half, because it's going to be different. I know we were talking off air. I just got done directing a show called The Christians that's going to be done 4 times in a matter of months here in central Indiana. So yeah, I think you think about the last time you saw a production of R&J and how it was done. And actually, you're talking about thought-provoking. The last time I saw Merchant was on the canal, and my daughter, yes, the infamous Emma Sosi, we'll get to, super theater fan. That's another story for another time. But I took her to that, and she was about, I think, 7, 8, and, sometimes a lot of it goes over. But on the way home, my daughter asked, "Dad, what's a loophole?" And I thought, okay, we'll take that. That's where she learned what a loophole is. So, and the other stuff will come with time. That's the beauty of art in college. It's always there for you. All right, Much Ado. I use the term psychotic romantic comedies, and you could actually say that Shrew is more of that than I say Much Ado, but if you look at films like My Best Friend's Wedding, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, Little Black Book, what? Philadelphia. Yeah, maybe to a certain degree, Philadelphia. And then all the Doris Rock Hudson films of the 50s. If normal-looking people acted that way, you would need a restraining order. But because it's Kate Hudson and Doris Day and Katharine Hepburn, and it's also well-written, there's a certain charm to it. With friends like, the friends of Benedict and Beatrice, with friends like them, who needs enemies? Especially in the garden. So, and I always use the equivalent. Full disclosure, I've done Much Ado years ago, but it's the Shakespeare version of saying to somebody in the schoolyard, "You like her,
you
like him."
It is, and that sort of happens actually in the play. Much Ado has been a passion project of mine. I actually grew up watching the movie, the Kenneth Branagh, Denzel Washington
movie. I graduated college when that came out. Thanks. Thank you so much.
That was the one that I would play on repeat anytime I was sick at home.
It's a lot of leather pants in slow motion.
So much. So many leather
pants. And there's somebody sunbathed improperly. If you know the sequence, you know what I'm talking about. Yeah.
So, but to me, I love the story, and I love the sort of psychotic romantic comedy, as you call it. I love the Keystone Cop dynamic of the sheriffs in the town and that whole thing. What's interesting to me is that you can have all of this comedy and all of this love and fun and lightheartedness, and still we have the Much Ado part. It gets pretty real for a while there. And something that always sort of troubled me about the story, the script in general, was the character of Don John. Don John is sort of...
There's no massaging and leather pants in the sequence?
Not in this one, no.
It's hard to sell that.
So I've sort of done a different take on Don John. It has always bothered me that he is a villain for the sake of being a villain, and he has no sort of comeuppance or retribution at the end. So I have created a character who I call Donna Joanna, and she is motivated by smashing the patriarchy and the misogyny of the time, and she does. I wrote a scene where she comes back and she gets her comeuppance, and we see sort of what unfolds for her after causing all of this.
But the
drama.
Pipers have to strike up first.
They will.
Okay.
They will. They still will.
Okay. Interesting. So
it's really a hilarious show.
Actually, since you brought that up, I would say I want to go across.
Midsummer, we'll get to you.
how much non-traditional casting was done in the shows this year?
For me, it was Donna Joanna. She's a female, where normally Don John is a male.
Right.
And other than that, I put together a couple of the smaller roles and just sort of combined them. But that was pretty much it.
Okay. Anybody else?
Yeah, I have quite a bit, actually. And it was during the casting process, it was really just a matter of going through auditions and whoever was better for the role. It wasn't necessarily in the beginning done on purpose. I just wanted the right person for the role, regardless of gender in my case. So I have a female Mercutio, and it's not a female actor playing a man. Mercutio is a woman in this show, as is Peter, the Capulet servant. My wife, Audrey, is playing that role. Who else do I?
You're looking at
you guys
me?
Don't remember my cast.
I haven't been at your rehearsals.
No. Friar Lawrence is now a woman as well.
With the first year of the Richmond Shakespeare Festival was R&J and Much Ado, and we unofficially called the season those Nutty Priests. Okay, here's
that's
your
exactly it. Yeah.
Here's your convoluted plan. Go. Okay.
Does
sure.
it work?
So, all right. How are things in the forest?
Going well. Well, not really, actually, in the forest.
Wait.
Not from Titania's perspective.
No. There's a couple different subplots going on. It can be a bit confusing. But basically, there's a kind of a love square almost thing going on. Between what we call the lovers.
A love rectangle,
yeah.
I believe? Or do we want to get into more geometric shapes?
Love rhombus.
Yeah.
You've just made my new band.
They end up in the forest, which is where Titania and Oberon, the fairy king and queen, live for the moment. But they're in a bit of a spat right now, so they're in a disagreement. And Oberon sees these lover people who are struggling a bit with love, as you do. And he tries to help, but kind of doesn't really help. he he tries, but it doesn't end well for that. But and then there's also the Rude Mechanicals, who are trying to put on a play for the human king and queen. And that's basically it. It all intertwines and ends up with a nice little
bow. And craziness ensues. One of the things I wanted to say about the Midsummer production is we were really excited this year to have a youth production come in. And we looked around at various different organizations that would provide that. And the company that came to us with really the best plan was Agape Theater Company, directed by Dr. Kathy Phipps. And, oh, my goodness, I went to several of their rehearsals and kind of expecting, for lack of a better term, a kid's show. Mm-hmm. It's not a kid's show. These are energetic, talented young people that have an energy and a drive that would put all of the adult shows to shame. They are
grown-up
really,
shows. We don't like to use the term adult shows
around
here.
Well, get over it because these guys are great, and they attack this show with a ferocity that I wish sometimes the grown-ups would do. In that particular
role. He looks at me when he says that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's an incredibly dynamic production, and they have really gone to the nine yards. They've got the beautiful costuming. They've got a set. They're in the new District Theater. It's a really big space for them. And they have – haven't you double cast the show?
Some of the leads are double cast. There's some understudies, yes, in the – understudies will have a show.
So counting all of your cast and all this, there's 84 actors involved in Bardfest this year.
Nice.
Yeah, so it's the biggest year we've ever had. But I was so impressed when I went to see the Midsummer. Isn't the music original as well?
I think so. It's kind of Celtic music.
And then you guys put all that together, and they're adorable. It's just a great show. I hope everybody gets a chance to see it.
Can you give a couple examples of some double casting? Because that's the other fun one. If to go from one character and then change costumes and then come back on as another, depending on time. Look up King Edward and Lord Mare, but that's me. Anyway, can you give us an example?
Well, there's understudies, really.
Okay.
There's the Helena, Hermia, Theseus, and some other people are understudies who, when they're doing the understudy show, when they're not doing the understudy show, other people will play the fairy roles that, like, understudy Hermia is also Peas Blossom. And so when she's Hermia, another person will play Peas Blossom.
I know I have, for those on radio, I know I have a screen in front of you. I'm sorry. Make sure you're all right. Are you working with a dog in this one?
No.
Tough call.
No.
That's tough. Well, union dogs are really hard to find. They want to break. They want to run around, lick themselves for 20 minutes. It kind of brings the show to a halt. It's all right. So
we have next year. I've already had a director pitch me Two Gentlemen of Verona, so we're going to be looking for a dog. So
I would say the last time I saw that show, I believe was Chicago Shakes, and those Chicago dogs they're classically trained. They're ready for that. So
with like pickles and stuff on them, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Whatever trick it takes.
Chicago dogs. Right?
Oh, there you go. Oh, that's. Yeah, all that stuff on a dog. See, these are dad jokes right here. So, all right. Once again, pitch the times and events, and the dates.
Oh, we are September 27th through October 7th, and check indiebardfest.com for tickets and for a schedule of the shows. Some nights show might start at 7:30, other nights it might start at 8:00.
Okay, and I guess I want to go around the board again. How was it as far as the cuttings for your shows? How much of it was pruning for time's sake, and how much of it was we don't need that?
For me, it was a little of both, and usually one cut both things would be true of a cut. It would be for if we don't need it, then great, it'll save time.
There'll be one scholar that just gets in a dander, and you'll deal with him, and it'll be fine.
That's okay. I will say I cut quite a bit from the very last scene of Romeo and Juliet. After their I don't want to ruin it for anybody.
Things happen.
Big event.
Remind me to tell you off air about I saw one with an alternate ending to that
interesting
story. Oh yeah,
like Romeo and Juliet, was it like the
that was shorter, yeah. But No, we'll get to Bard Cinnamon a little bit.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Well, I cut quite a bit of the ending after you know a lot of the Watchmen talking about what happened and summing up what
exposition.
We've just seen. It's like, you know, at the exposition,
the Doritos postgame report.
Yeah. We don't need to, you know, we'll have a talk back. We don't need the actors to do that. So a lot of that is gone, and it's pretty much, you know, so the final scene really moves towards the climax, and then we're out of there. So that to me was important, just to keep it moving and try to get a sense of pace. And it's difficult when you're looking at a script. It's different than seeing actors on a stage. So you really have to visualize what that's going to look like when you're cutting something and kind of hear it in your head a little bit, maybe say it out loud. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So, I think to your point, doing it for time, but also for the you know, the sake of keeping it simple and keeping things moving.
They all can't be Ken Branagh's Hamlet. That's just...
And nor should they be.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, no, I think like, as you said, I mean, there was a little of each, and some of it, I'm cutting the same thing for both reasons. Cause,
right.
Those Watchmen.
Right.
Your Watchmen are great.
but who watches them? thank you.
Exactly.
No, but most of it was. I mean, I'm fortunate because this is actually not one of his longer scripts.
Yes.
As they go, so I really didn't have to cut all that much. I pruned out a few things. I have eliminated the character of Old Gabo. He's not there. Lancelot Gabo is still there, but Old Gabo.
Angry
is
scholars in I three,
know. You know what?
Two.
That's
one,
right.
Bring it.
Bring
yeah.
it.
Shaking
okay.
their fists, screaming at clouds.
But yeah. The rest is just trimming here and there. All the scenes are present. I haven't cut any entire scenes. It's just, you know, trimming here and there. Some mm-hmm. of the speeches just for moving things along under the strict time limit that we were given.
Okay. Very good.
For me, Beatrice and Benedict have a lot of flowery language. They like to talk a lot to and about each other. So trimming that down was a bit of a challenge because you don't want to lose that. You want to keep that language and that feel, that wit, but you have to fit it into the time slot. So I went about it sort of trimming and cutting, also knowing that I was going to add this Donna Joanna scene. So a little bit different for me, but I think for the most part, it's just things that are not consequential to understanding the show.
I remember my director saying, there aren't that many monologues in this. And I stood up and went, I have five. Shut up. Then again, if you really want to test the audience, and we always joked about, you know, at the wedding, Beatrice could just kick Don John the rocks.
Don't give it away.
Tell Claudio to grow a pair and then tell Benedict, come, and the play's over. But the test audience didn't want that. So.
I believe they were just a bit trimming of monologues, probably, but we didn't cut that much at all. In fact, we added a bit of song and dance.
Well, you can do that. You can romp in the woods with that.
Yeah.
That's cool. So
you got the big wedding at the end.
That is. Mm-hmm. That is
when
very,
when mm-hmm. I played Peter Quince a few years ago, and we had a big dance number at the end. Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. All right. So anyway, that is Bardfest. So go check these out. There's 82, 83 people that you would love to see, and it's going to be a lot of fun. And you so. Will there be some where there's two shows in the same night, like back and forth, or?
Yeah, we have 24 shows over two weekends. We start on a Thursday, we went through Sunday, and on the Saturdays and Sundays, I believe there's four shows in rotation going on. So if there's
buy a drink for the one that does the foursome.
And the other thing I can announce that isn't public yet is the Indianapolis Opera Company. Is doing an original work of Romeo and Juliet, not a rehash one. It's an original work, and they'll be featuring selections of that Ooh. On our first weekend on the outdoor stage while the audience is coming in and out. So that's very exciting as well.
All right, very good. So go check that out. All right, I want to open the floor up. Shakespeare in cinema, your thoughts, your memories, your encounters.
I hate Baz Luhrmann.
Wow.
I just got that much more interested in seeing your show.
Yeah.
Try being the two oldest ones in the theater when that thing came out.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I can imagine. Yeah.
Playing slight devil's advocate, at least it got some butts in the seats. It was a 101 for a lot of people.
There's not everything about it is terrible. I watched it again recently. Six, 8 months ago.
To see if you were right still?
Yeah, I think in my mind I was like, okay, I can't accidentally do something that is in that movie.
Julieta!
Right.
So you don't need a swimming pool?
No, I don't have a swimming pool. That
you
was
have
not
a long
in,
sword
that was not in the budget.
With a chamber in it?
Right. Oh, yeah, that's what I can't. So some of it, once you get into it with, I think DiCaprio is really good. I like Claire Danes.
When people's heads turn, do they go, whoosh?
It's all the stuff,
Shabra.
Hey, we get it that it's, wow, the gun is a sword and he's using the, he's a little, to use a word that you used before, he's a little heavy handed with the, it's like beating someone over the head with the 90s is the image that I get, Hey, is that enough 90s
well,
for you?
That
you
will
want some more 90s?
Will not make the back of the DVD Blu-ray box.
Yeah, it's I think even seeing it in the 90s, I thought that, So it's the opening sequence with the gas station fight. I find it.
El Mariachi.
I find it unwatchable. It's just not.
Not too long after that came out, I played in our version Father Lawrence in Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, right.
And the kid playing Romeo was determined to be Leo DiCaprio, no matter what else was happening on
stage.
So you
didn't get a giant tattoo on the back on your back, right?
Well, no, but I mean, what he was doing was clearly copying Leo DiCaprio, and it was agonizing. So.
Yeah,
because he's not Leo DiCaprio.
Right. Also, the fact that I think your two best performances come from the nurse and the friar, Pete Postlethwaite and Miriam Margolyes, salute to both of them. That's a little problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now you say you mentioned Much Ado. That have you seen Joss Whedon's take on it?
I have not.
It is the fact that you watch Ken's first helps. It is a great compare contrast in styles.
I'm slightly worried that it would ruin it for me.
How so?
I haven't seen it. I'm not sure. I haven't heard great things about it.
Well, I would say that the beauty of this show, of doing a show, all of your shows, is once you've had an experience with it, and I'll use the example. After the week after my Much Ado closed, I got up early on a Sunday morning, made a pot of coffee, and I watched the Ken version, which I had not seen in a few years. But that was something I would watch almost once a year. And because I had my own experience with the story, the art changed. For me. The art doesn't change. We change. So, and it didn't make it better, and it didn't make it worse. And I wasn't sitting there going, that choice or that choice. It's just different because you've had your own experience with the story. So the fact is, Keanu Reeves is an easy target. You don't turn that gig down, right? You're going to wear white cotton and leather and eat fruit in Italy and do
get
Shakespeare.
A massage.
Yeah, get a massage 20 times if you're Kubrick, 80 times if you're Kubrick. But you don't turn that gig down. And it looked like just a romping, fun summer in Italy. And Whedon's version, it looks like a weekend cocktail party. In black and white, it's a little tamer in tone. But there's still some of the physicality. I mean, still obviously the physicality nonsense and fun stuff, and Nathan Fillion is Dogberry, which is, and that's and that the Dogberry story sometimes, like, meanwhile in another play elsewhere, thus the farting Michael Keaton sort of thing in Ken's version. But anyway, it's just a great exercise in different tones.
That's interesting. You should mention that. That's something I was kind of had in my mind when I said I would direct this show was. I don't want to take what I know of the movie and mimic it and
of course.
Put it on the stage. You want to have a different take on it. And that's not even something that I've had to worry about because the actors that I have brought these characters to a whole new dimension, to a whole new level that I never thought about, mm-hmm. things that I never thought I could like more about the story. I was already so in love with it, I didn't think I could like it anymore, and I do. It's phenomenal to see what they've done.
Excellent.
I haven't seen that many Shakespeare movies, honestly, but it seems to me that Shakespeare has a certain aura about it that fits very well on the stage that I feel you would just lose in, on film.
Sure, sure. That's all right. You're also young, so you have time.
Yes, yes. So
I'll loan you Much Ado.
Yes.
I think I said before, Branagh's Henry V, that's really got me in love with Shakespeare back then.
And
I watched that movie 100 times. I love that show.
And that helped start the wave. I mean, there was a spurt of Shakespeare films in the 90s, mm-hmm. and it started with Ken, and then, you know, Mel Gibson's geriatric Hamlet. oh, he's fine, and Glenn Close is a good sport. But, you know, the big story is, you know, the good news is Mel Gibson wants you to be in Hamlet. The bad news is you're playing Gertrude. Oh, thanks. So, but yeah, there was a kind of a glut with those, and I think it kind of hit its peak with Mr. Lehrman's show, Who Will Not Be Named. It's an ampersand, not a plus.
Right.
So anyway, but it's cool. There is one I want to mention. I recently watched a film Movement, which is a great, almost like a film of the month club that you get online. Occasionally they will film plays and put them on disc. And there is a production of Hamlet with Maxine Peake playing it, and it's done in an alley style. And it looks like, and I don't think it's the same location, but there was a production of Midsummer that was done. It looks like a fashion runway, but it's an alley, a long alley shape. And I believe it was, I want to say Trevor Nunn had directed it. But you have a female Polonius, Player King, Rosencrantz, and Gravediggers on top of the female Hamlet. And so anyway, it was another addition. There's probably 5 or 6 versions of Hamlet in my library, and, you know, ranging from Olivier to this. So long as you find, again, like a production, if you get something out of it that's different than the previous instead of a retread, I think that's pretty cool. So,
well, the Pacino Merchant.
Not as yelly screamy as other Pacino films, believe it or not.
That's true. But I almost wish it were, because it looks gorgeous. The production is gorgeous, but it is also deathly, deathly dull.
Have you seen his documentary, Looking for Richard?
I have. It's lovely.
It is very cool.
It's fascinating.
If you get a chance, I mean, anybody, whether you're directing or acting, it about how American actors and English actors look at Shakespeare, how audience members look at it, and then when he has his spare time and he can round up some usual suspects like Winona Ryder, Kevin Spacey, you know, they film these quick little bits of Richard III, and he cobbled together a documentary that's pretty informative. Good stuff. All right. We just still got a few minutes. I'm just opening it up again. The gang from Bardfest is here. I know you've all been busy.
Nah.
Have you watched anything recently, or is there? I mean, I tend to be. I will wind down by putting something in. I recently got a Blu-ray of the Michael Schultz film Car Wash, and watched that. So,
wow.
the commentary track. Very cool.
Nice.
Very excited. So,
nice.
Yeah, I haven't watched. It wasn't a film, but my wife and I just obsessed over The Americans. We just binged that entire thing, and that was amazing. I really, really enjoyed that show.
Cool.
Yeah.
And it finished its run, right?
It did.
Okay.
It did. And then the writers and the lead actor got Emmys this year.
Correct.
And, I don't think since Breaking Bad have I seen a show that was really done that well. It was very, very good.
Cool.
Yeah.
So usually if I'm not working on something, specifically directing something, I try to watch like a movie every day if I can, you know, but you know, it's a different, your life is different when you're working. So what I've been doing is just putting on reruns of Frasier because I know it so well, you know, it's just, and
there
was
something about
very,
that. I mean, whether it's in the background or you're working on something,
I can sit and watch it, or I can do something else. And I still know, you know, if I can only hear it, I know exactly what is happening on the
nope,
screen.
Nobody's
winding, so many times.
Nobody's winding down with Persona after a long rehearsal night.
Right.
Okay.
I did. You mentioned the Maltese Falcon earlier. I saw that a couple weeks ago at the Artcraft Theater.
Oh, on a big screen. That's even better.
And it was, well, yeah, I mean, I'd seen it several times before, but never in a movie theater. And it's just with with an audience, it's completely different. It changes the tone of the movie entirely.
Gardenia, send him right in.
Yeah, and it's just a blast, you know. So
bloated idiot.
Well, yeah, I haven't had much opportunity to watch a whole lot. A lot of times when I get home. My wife has been watching a lot of Midsummer Murders, that sort of British murder she wrote, except better. she's been watching a lot of that, and I'll, you know, sit and pick up wherever I am, right. Wherever it is when I come in. I think the last film I sat down and watched was Blade Runner 2049.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah. No, I was very impressed with it.
Very cool. Yeah.
I tend to follow what Zach does. I like to throw on Netflix. It's been The Office lately that I've just been rewatching over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
We did squeeze in Jurassic World the other day in two parts.
That's new on video. Uh-huh. Bryce wears flats, right? So
mm-hmm.
that's taken care of.
Yes,
wonderful.
She does.
Great.
She runs the exact same in flats and heels. It blows my mind. I don't understand.
I love that those are that's the little things like that. Like, really? That? Yeah, it's,
mm-hmm.
it kind of takes you out of
but
it.
But I believe it. I mean, I know plenty of women who can run in heels. It's just not me. I can walk like a toddler in
me
heels.
Me too.
So that's about it.
Exactly. Makes me 5'8", so.
We've been watching not much, honestly. I've been busy, but
sure.
I know, right?
Doing a thing.
Though we started watching a TV show that's like the children of all the Musketeers, mm-hmm. who are like Musketeers now, and it's interesting to see how they are doing that.
Wait. So it's the children of the Musketeers, or it's the Musketeers as children?
No, it's the children of the Musketeers. Their descendants.
Gosh,
yeah.
Porthos, Athos.
Yeah, I was concerned.
Great parenting skills there. Wow. Well, at least they're not the cardinal. a couple other notes on since Jurassic World it was brought up. The new on Blu-ray this week, the miniseries of Fahrenheit 451. Mm-hmm. If you don't want to watch Truffaut, but you should. Anyway, that's Michael B. Jordan and Michael Shannon. And also Criterion has put out My Man Godfrey. On the Blu-ray list, so another fun date film, and if you ever get to see that on a big screen, that's even better. So, all right, once again, give the dates and the website and all the information for Bardfest.
The website is indiebardfest.com. You can go there for tickets and for a festival schedule, and the dates are September 27th through October 7th.
There is also a special show, Much Ado About Nothing, on October 11th at the Needhammer downtown Indy.
Okay, there's one. Okay, I got maybe a minute. The AV Club of the Onion. They have a little AV Q&A, and today's list: 7 overplayed songs that still make us happy in movie trailers. No, Smash Mouth is not on this. Mad World from it's the cover of Mad World. Mr. Blue Sky by ELO.
Oh yeah,
there you go. Lux Aeterna, which was used in Requiem for a Dream. Rolling Stones' Gimme Shelter, or at least 3 Scorsese films.
Yeah.
James Brown's I Feel Good. No, that's overused. Edvard Grieg's In the Hall of the Mountain King, because of Corpse Bride, Grinch Stole Christmas, and Funny Games. And then finally, Buffalo Springfield's For What It's Worth. So now those songs are in your head. You're welcome. Ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent Breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. Go to Bardfest, because you really should do that. So you're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point and WFYI.org. Thanks for hanging out, gang.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep, no more, and by asleep, to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to the consummation devoutly to be wished, to die, to sleep, a chance to dream. Aye, there's the rub. For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil must give us pause. There's the respect that makes calamity of so long life.